Hello and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 28. And this is with Mouthy Buddha. And Mouthy Buddha started off, I first discovered his channel, well, I don't know when it was, maybe February or March this year, I think. And I can't recall now, sometime around then. And at that time, it seemed like a skeptic channel, but then he started to stray from that line. And at some point, that he was going all right and so on. And it's still very much a unique channel, very unique perspective, and well-made videos. We were just talking just now about that before we went on air. So welcome, Mouthy.
Thank you for having me.
So I suppose we should first talk about your relationship or your perceptions of the alt-right. So, well, actually, before we get into that, let's talk about why and how you started your channel.
Well, I started my channel because I was watching a lot of AIU, Atheism is Unstoppable. And I thought he was bringing in kind of a unique visual flair to his videos and his content. And I thought, well, I wanted to do something like that. So it was probably about a year and a half ago, I started to make content. It started off pretty terrible, but what I wanted to do was try and make videos that were more cinematic and musical and entertaining, because so many kind of do the direct-to-camera thing, which is great because we need deep thinking stuff, but I'm not a deep thinker. I don't have big ideas. I'm not really an idea person. I'm much more a person who tries to craft like narrative-driven videos that can engage people, entertain people. I don't so much like the word entertain. I feel like it kind of degrades what it is I'm trying to do because I'm also trying to provoke, you know, people's thinking. And I think it's so fascinating operating within the circles that I do because I have a lot of alt-right followers, but then I have a lot of, I guess we could, again, these are vague generalizations that I'm using, but just I have many people who would, I guess, associate with the alt-right, many people who would associate themselves in the skeptosphere, and then kind of, you know, some progressives and all in between. And I think that what I'm trying to do is feed people stuff that I would want to watch. So I got started on YouTube for that reason. I wanted to, you know, make engaging content.
Right. And you approached it very much as a more artistic process than sort of like a talking head. Would you say that?
I would, yes.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, there are similarities between your channel or your style and ContraPoints in the lighting and the editing, the filming and so on. But I don't mean that as besmirch you. I am sorry. I just mean it on that superficial level.
If there's one thing about ContraPoints, it's that the videos that come out of that channel are brilliant. I mean, I disagree with what they say, but the lighting and the way it's edited is very, very well done. And I would say that sometimes when I see those videos, it does light a fire under my ass of like, okay, I got to start doing better here.
Well, you know, there's a danger in that though, because there's a danger that you start going for style over substance and taking ages to make any one video. Mm. You know, that would be stultifying after pretty quickly. I mean, I think your videos are very well made as they are, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. But right. Then, you know, I go for sort of minimal aesthetic because I want to make so many videos that I can't afford. I mean, there's just been no question of, you know, doing fancy editing with illustrating everything I'm talking about. You know, I couldn't do that. But right. I know that obviously your channel is very different from mine.
Yes.
So I suppose at some point, you ran into the alt-right. So tell me your perceptions of that.
Well, I think the alt-right is very interesting. I think that people need to get rid of the taboo around talking about it or associating with it. Because I think that they're not afraid to talk about certain ideas that are very uncomfortable to talk about. And I think that in some ways they're doing a decent job of at least lifting that that taboo or moving the window, so to speak. However, I do have some obvious criticisms of the movement, and I have been relatively vocal about it. But in general, I have most of the people, I wouldn't say most, maybe half of my online friends, just a bulk of this community, is alt-right, and we talk all the time. And I think that there's this misconception that alt-righters are mean, or they are strident, or they hate other people. And that's not what I've received from the group of people that I speak with. However, I mean, some of the ideas that arise out of some of my alt-right friends, I would consider to probably still need a bit of a taboo on it. Things like eugenics, forced eugenics. Some of my friends are proponents of that. And I disagree with things like that. And
it's funny, you know, I'm guessing that most of your friends, your alt-right friends, are American. And it's funny that in America, there seems to be always this undercurrent of authoritarianism. Like, they'd be perfectly fine with the government implementing something like forced eugenics. Because after all, it would solve a problem. So what's your objection to it? I mean, it's a funny thing, because obviously America has the self-image of being all about freedom and the individual. But there does seem to be, and I think this does plug into the alt-right, in a sense, there does seem to be a desire to just get things done. Ideally, it'd be better if the government just did it.
Yeah, see, I don't like that. That's terrible. And I think that's, but again, I mean, you have a lot of diversity of thought, you know, ironically enough, in the movement. You have a lot of people who are anti-authoritarian, who are libertarians. You know, not all of the alt-right are fascists, which is we know that, but many people don't. They see just kind of a blanket wing of authoritarian views. However, I mean, this isn't to say that many are, in fact, authoritarian and are trying very much to implement, you know, authoritarian ideas into what we do. People are trying to push those kinds of ideas in different means. I'm certainly not personally authoritarian at all. I mean, I'm probably one of the most live and let live people that I know. I try to just, and that's why I struggle so much with the alt-right, because it's all about order. It's all about maintaining structures and hierarchies and foundations and traditions. And I very much, I mean, dude, at the end of the day, I really think most of that, if not all of it, is just an illusion of experience. But it doesn't mean that we can't hold on to values that are worth holding on to. But the way that I view the world is very much like we should just be able to do what we want when we want. Now, when we start talking about demographics, that conversation can certainly change, because you're operating about different groups of people who have different interests, and that changes the conversation. You might not be able to still hold on to your libertarianism once you acknowledge certain unfortunate facts about demographics. And, you know, I'm still grappling with that. I'm not sure if many in the alt-right have it completely, have that assumption completely right, that multiple races cannot live together in harmony, or that it won't take a certain amount of time until they can ultimately live together. If the environment ultimately won't make some changes, because there are some environmental factors, anywhere from like 20% all the way up to 50%, that influence human intelligence. So I think those are interesting aspects that I don't hear the alt-right emphasizing very much. Actually, when I say the alt-right, it's very difficult to talk about the alt-right, because there's so many. Like, if I ever try to criticize the alt-right, someone from the alt-right will say, well, I don't think that, and I'm in the alt-right. So suppose I could just say many in the alt-right say this, ..
One thing I would say is about the 20 to 50% IQ thing, that comes from, we think it's between 20, so we think it's between 50 and 80% heritability with IQ.
Right.
But I think the reason that some people will not talk about using environmental factors to ameliorate those discrepancies is that they don't actually care about the IQ thing so much. What they care about is their race and their ethnic identity, or their racial identity. So the IQ thing is almost incidental. I mean, you know, one of those things that people who don't know much about the alt-right say to the alt-right is, well, East Asians have a higher IQ than whites, so presumably you want to get taken over by East Asians. And they don't realize that, no, it's not really... I mean, the IQ thing is just another layer. It's just another reason why we don't want to be taken over by the third world. But the first reason is that we are not the third world. We are something else. We are us. So, you know, that basic awareness of what we are, what our ancestors represent, and what it all coalesces into, the awareness of that is what makes us want to stand together and protect it and resist outsiders. And then, on top of that, you get all the stuff like Islam is going to fuck everything up, the Hispanics will bring their culture, and the blacks will bring their problems.
Well, I mean, when you talk about identity, generally, what is it you're talking about?
Well, Sargon once asked me that in a private conversation. He asked me, what did I mean by peoplehood? And I think you and I are quite similar in that we consider ourselves outsiders and a bit eccentric, a bit odd, and we're probably quite proud of that. We take some smugness out of that, you know. But the fact is that, well, I don't know about your case. I don't know what your ethnic background is. But certainly if you just look at the cultural angle, I am a product of Britain. I am a product of the British people. And Britain is largely constituted, you know, culturally, socially, politically, by what we can still call the native British people. You know, it's not, I mean, yes, it's multicultural, multiracial now, but its systems, its culture is still largely the result of the native British people from 50 years ago. So I am a product of that culture, and I'm a product of that people. So regardless of my own feelings of, you know, individuality and whatever, I do owe them my existence. Now, obviously, any individual, any person builds himself in his life through his actions and his interests and all the rest of it. And I think it's important not to understate that because it would just be dishonest to understate that. Each individual is responsible for what he becomes. But what he becomes, well, it's the path towards that starts from his group identity. And what he becomes should also reflect, to some extent, his group identity.
See, that's an assumption that I don't know I could, individually get behind. Because I think this is where we disagree philosophically and experientially on identity. And again, when I start talking about identity, at the end of the day, I'm still for free association and disassociation. I still acknowledge that the real world exists and that we have serious problems that we have to grapple with. So don't think that by any means I'm just tossing out the real world when I say that identity is an illusion. But identity is an illusion. And it's not an illusion just because I say it is. It's a conscious illusion of experience. Because what it actually is a thought. It's like an embedded thought process. So when I asked you about your identity, your mind was kind of working with, you know, ancestry and these kind of amalgamations of different notions of who you think yourself to be. And you just kind of listed off a bunch of things. But I mean, I could ask, well, where are all of those things? And then that kind of forces the mind to say,
well, that's, yeah, you could equally say, where is the number four?
Right. Oh, so you're saying like four is in the objective world.
Well, it's a product of our thoughts, obviously. It's something that we conceive of in our minds and work with. And I would say that identity is the same thing. Obviously, it's not, it has a physical basis, but in and of itself, it is not a physical thing in the material world. But it's a concept that is useful to us.
Well, see, okay.
It's conjured by us, I think, concert, and then we use it.
Right. I think it's useful in that it can help with our social lives and the fact that we don't go run in front of a car and get hit by it. We need some sense of self, some sense of identity to navigate our conscious space. But there are ways of experiencing the world in which the illusion of identity dips away. And all of these concepts and notions of self just kind of fall away. And this is what I think is the fundamental reality of what it means to be human, which is conscious, pure consciousness, Christ consciousness, whatever, which is basically, it's like this fundamental, it's the fundamental identity, because it's not predicated on any thought pattern. And how, like, so I'm assuming, would you be willing to grant that identity is an illusion, but that you just use it anyway? Or that, because here's my main problem with it. Because identity is illusory, I see movements like identity politics as being just totally confused. Now, if you want to be an identitarian and you live in an ethno state, that's completely fine. But in America, and now in Europe, unfortunately, to be an identitarian is a kind of road to nowhere. Unless you split everyone up into their own ethno states, then they can just be identitarians. But now it causes all of this because you're building more and more in groups with their biases. So would you be willing to admit that identity, though illusory, can be useful? Or do you not grant that it's an illusion?
I think it's partly an illusion, but it's also based in the real world. You know, for a start, it's based in genetics. But it's also based in the culture that you encounter as a baby, as a child, and are thus shaped by. And that is not an illusion.
What is not an illusion?
The shaping of your character by the culture around you.
Yeah.
And also another thing would be ancestry. It is a fact that my ancestors were British. Quarter of them were Italian, but let's forget about that.
Right.
Because that's an imperfect example. Three quarters of them, let's just put it that way, were British, and they existed in those isles for God knows how many centuries or millennia. So it's just a fact. That's not an illusion.
Well, no. It's a fact about human evolution, but it's not a fact about experience. It's an experiential illusion to claim that consciousness has a link to something, some form of ancestry. Because as a matter of experience, let me try and say it like this. Present moment awareness has no identity. It just is. And these are kinds of mind states that more and more humans are able to achieve through methods like meditation or taking psychedelic drugs. And it gets to the fabric of reality, which is just experience. And when I see movements like the alt-right, or like, you know, trans identity and all these identity movements, I wonder if they've ever had that experience of self-transcendence. Because I know that for me, when I look out and I see things like Charlottesville, though in some cases justified, again, I have to stress that I'm not condemning people for behaving or reacting to certain things. I'm just saying there's a core experiential fact that seems to be lost on most of us. And it's that the majority of our lives, we're kind of conducting a story about our life. And it's not actually true about who we really are. It's not.
Who else could we really be?
Pure consciousness. I mean, there is an identity, there is a feeling of being, in consciousness. There is a feeling of being and of doing things, but there's no one who is doing it. So it's kind of like a non-dual awareness. And I personally believe that to be the fundamental nature of consciousness, which is just to be. And then everything that gets attached onto that, you know, oh, I had a bad day the other day. Well, that's past. Oh, I have this thing that I'm waiting for in the future. Okay, well, that's the future. And that's the kind of thought patterns that get embedded in our conscious experience. We're constantly moved and pulled by our thoughts, and they are responsible when we identify with them for a whole host of suffering, for depression and anxiety.
I would say that the present is something that has to be used selectively. You can't just be stuck in the present. That's a philosophical tool and even a spiritual tool, but it can't. I don't think that it can work in general. You have to allow the past to inform you and reassure you and comfort you, and you have to allow the future to inspire you and excite you. Mm-hmm. Because
I just said no. I mean, I think that we disagree on because, okay, look, I totally get it's a totally rational and reasonable thing to say. Like, why wouldn't you learn from your mistakes? Like, are you just gonna?
No, I don't mean just learn from the mistakes. I mean more deep and broad than that.
Mm.
Because that's treating the past like a sort of instruction manual or something. Mm. I would see the past more as a story, and the future as a story, you know, all one long continuum.
Mm. Well, I see notions of past and future as kind of illusory ghosts that are shitting all over the present moment. I mean, because so much about our day-to-day thought life is mired in the past and the future, and none of it's good. Like, most of it is awful. Most of it is worry.
Look, there is a danger. It's not one thing or the other. There is obviously a danger in being stuck in the past, or a danger in always living for the future and never actually attending to things in the here and now. Actually, I think a lot of people who get lost in ideas are doing that, essentially. They're
right.
Sacrificing, you know, they're fetishizing the future or obsessing over it so that they don't have to deal with their problems in the here and now. But then again, by doing so, they're sort of making a sacrifice because they're building towards something in the future that other people can benefit from.
Mm. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think our disagreement comes from you see more utility in identity than I do. Would that be a correct assumption?
Oh, I think so. It sounds like it. But
right.
I have to ask, what is your ethnic background?
I am half Scottish, half Hispanic.
Wow.
I knew you would love that.
You're equally Scottish as I am.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
How do you feel? How do you feel about deep fried Mars bars?
Oh, I can't get enough.
Wow, I can't believe it. Mouthy Buddha's half Scottish.
Yeah, and I believe that one of my, I guess, since we're talking about ancestry, either my great great grandpa or something like that was a Wallace, but I could be wrong.
Well,
was he
I
not?
Can't claim any.
Right.
I don't know. That would be very difficult to. I mean, I don't even know when that was. Was that the 11th century?
I have no fucking clue, but yeah. I have my uncle tells us that. Mm.
Well, so half Scottish and half Spanish, did you say?
Yes.
Right. Okay. But and then is that sort of straight into America, or did they go back via South America, or what?
Wait. What's the question now?
I'm asking: did your parents move from, or your grandparents move from Spain and Scotland to America, or via somewhere else?
No, they were both from America.
Right. Okay. Well. I'm just curious about that because it seems that you are separated from that. And by the way, I'm not holding that against you. I think that a lot of Americans are, and this is why there probably is a need
But
I don't know. This is the question of to what extent should Americans care about European identity and see themselves as Europeans? That's maybe a different thing. But I can understand why you cannot place yourself in Scotland. Have you ever been to Scotland?
Before you go where I think you're going, I would say that the notion that an individual sees identity as illusory because it seems like you're predicating identity only to race, because people can have an identity on all kinds of different bases.
Oh, now look, now hold on. Let me address that, because this is why I began by saying that I see myself as an outsider, and I always have done, because I didn't feel like, you know, every other Scottish person, or even more narrow than that, every other middle-class Scottish male born in the early 80s. You know, there's clearly a huge part of identity that is unique to the individual. And obviously it's going to vary by individual. With some of them, they won't be that unique. With some of them, they will be, whatever. But again, that does not negate the group identity, the group part of your identity. But again, this is why I asked you about your ethnic background, because you are directly caught between two possible national identities. And this is why it's like with me, I'm three quarters British, and that just totally annihilates the quarter Italian in my perception. So, I mean, Italy's just a nice place to go for me. It's not home.
But hold on. But why, that confuses me, because you're saying, so it would sound like you also have some kind of built-in internal, are you claiming that you have some kind of built-in internal resistance or some kind of multifaceted identity because you are of different races or of different ethnicities?
No, I would say that the way I see it is that I am me, and that is a composite of, it's obviously a unique product, but it's a composite of these ingredients, and some of the ingredients overpower some of the other ingredients. So yeah, the quarter Italian, I mean, maybe it does factor into my, I don't know, my visual tastes or something like that, but it's sort of just working silently. It doesn't really matter in terms of how I describe myself and conceive of myself.
Mm. Okay, well, because for a second it sounded like you were placing almost like conscious things that didn't need to be there. Like you're the one placing these multi-identity things onto your conscious experience. Whereas, because look, I've been interested in meditation for a long, long time. And I never had any like thought of my own race. Now, this was probably because, you know, I lived in a majority white. I had no reason to, because I look white. I look like a white guy. So I had no reason to think about race. And it hasn't been until, you know, I would say I started looking at the ideas of the alt-right, honestly, that I've just learned more about this. But there's no part of me that feels more white than Hispanic. I wouldn't even know how to describe that to you as a conscious experience.
Well, that's probably because Hispanic is in itself a thing. That is in itself an identity. So it's very difficult for you to choose between white and Hispanic, because...
But there is no choice. It's like, what would be how would one choose consciously to behave more white than Hispanic?
The question of behavior is a separate thing. I'm speaking purely about identity, and perhaps the word discern would be better than the word choose. Discern what you are. What is the best way to approximate the result of your genetic makeup?
Right. That's a great, yeah. How would one discern if their identity is more white than his, see, identity is so much bigger than race, and it's so much smaller than it too. It's like
But let's. I understand it. I know exactly what you're going to say. But let's put it this way. There are 1,000 white people in your town. You live in a town of 2,000 people.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
1,000 white people and 1,000 blacks. There's a disagreement, and the whites are probably wrong, to be honest, but who are you going to side with anyway?
Right, yeah, I understand that. And I would say that that's an ignorance on my part if I actually follow through with...
Yeah, but you're only human.
True. I think that's... What I'm trying to put forward here is... passing through that ignorance by, and now again, this doesn't toss out the ignorance of humanity. We should still disassociate and be free to associate with who we want. But there's this core fundamental fact of individual conscious experience, and it's void of identity. It doesn't have an identity attached to it. And when we start talking about, no, it's Hispanic, or no, it's this, or that's absurd. I mean, because there is no basis to make a claim on pure consciousness at all. I mean, you can't, like, consciousness doesn't have a race. Would you admit that?
Well, I don't know what you mean by consciousness.
Just being aware, the act of being aware.
Well, yeah, but who is being aware?
That's a very good question. I would argue that consciousness itself can be aware. There doesn't have to be a self that is aware. Now, when I make these claims...
Well, hold on a minute. Hold on a minute, though. I don't want to ruin your flow, but what conscious entity does not have a self?
Well, consciousness doesn't have a self. The self is a construction made up of thoughts and memories.
Yeah, so where is the consciousness that is not tied to a self?
Well, I would call it a higher self, because it's not the actual identity of, like, oh, I'm going to my car, I'm going to do... It's not that thing that's mired in thought. It's just pure consciousness, which is just experience itself. It's just the world, just being. That in itself is consciousness. It's void of identity, it's void of self, and everything else attached to that is illusory. And my main argument is that when we start getting into these notions of identity, we should at least fucking know the thing's an illusion.
So, because we do things on autopilot, is that when are you referring to when we do things just by instinct?
I mean, no, that's not what I'm claiming. I'm saying that I don't think I understand the question. What do you mean by doing things on instinct?
Well, I'm trying to work out what is when we enact consciousness without it stemming from or being controlled by our sense of self. See, this thing about pure consciousness, I have to say I'm skeptical about that notion.
Right. Well, have you ever done any meditation, or have you ever taken psychedelics?
I've taken psychedelics, yeah.
Have you ever done, like, extensive retreats, like for meditation?
No.
Okay. Well, That's great. I think that explains why we can be so gripped to our identities, because we've never experienced life without it. We've never seen it go. We've never seen it drift away from our conscious experience and to just be with what is. It's a fucking amazing thing. And once the mind catches it, you can do it all the time, as I do.
Well, can you describe that more? Because I took psychedelics, and what happened? I mean, I did it many times in my early 20s, mushrooms, and other drugs, and they wear off. And even during the thing, it was still, at the height of a trip, it's still you,
right?
Isn't
yeah.
it?
Well, yeah,
or
absolutely.
Is it not? I mean, I don't know. You tell me.
Everyone has different experiences, and I think that some people – the reason why I ask that is because some people can take psychedelics, and it can give a kind of a transcendent of the self, and you can be in a different conscious – or actually, you're just – you can transcend the self with psychedelics. But a more practical application I could put to you is to say that you can also transcend the self. I know this sounds like bullshit, but it's actually very practical and empirical. You can – let me not say transcend the self, because it sounds fucking stupid. You can experience the world without an identity through meditation techniques. It's just basic mindfulness, just awareness. You can.
Well, why would you want to do that though?
Whoa! Because it's fucking brilliant. Because look, identity is what gives rise to all the suffering. Think about all the thoughts that go through your mind, all the anxiety riddled ideas. Oh,
don't mention thoughts. I'm just kidding.
Right. But the reason is because it's liberating. It's like coming home. And it's because it's void of all of the attachments to anything. You're just there. Us Westerners immediately go, oh, well, you're just going to fucking be a hippie and go out into the woods and just sit there. Oh, well, you know, we got machines working. You need to do work. I get it. Okay. But right now I'm just focusing on the claim, which is true, which is that meditation can't, and the reason why we would want to do this is because it's like ending suffering in the moment and just experiencing existence without the self, if only for a moment, can be one of the most transformative experiences of our lives. It's just so fascinating to experience existence as it is, without John or Mouthy or Woes or and all of the baggage consciously that comes with, the notions of identity, all of it just drops out and you're just left.
But I want that baggage. I want that baggage.
Well, okay. Well, that's where we disagree. I think that, and I get that too, because the ego is awesome. You know what I mean? There's so much, there is that human element of, you know, going through adversity, and it's a Christian thing too. And there, I totally get it. There, it's good to go through trials and tribulations and go and come out the other side a better person. And we want that kind of drama and stuff. But what I'm saying is that there's also another way, and it's a way of letting go of all of it, and it's far more peaceful than, you know, the kind of day-to-day neuroticism that most of us go through.
Well, that's true. I can understand what you're saying there. What I would say is that, turbulence is nothing to be afraid of, and peace is not something to, crave all the time. Mm. It's okay to be something. It's okay to not be pure consciousness.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not trying to, convince anybody of anything. I think that I personally find it interesting to talk about with the alt-right, to those who, you know, are happy to talk about it, because a lot of people think that, you know, it's just completely stupid to discuss, but I think it's totally relevant to talk about, well, then what the fuck is identity? Where is it? Where's your identity? And a lot of times when you ask,
well, in that town with 2,000 people, you would know your identity. I don't think you'd be confused about it at all.
Right. And unless I was enlightened
and dead, because that's the thing. I mean, ultimately you'd be no use to either side. So,
Right. And that puts us right back into the practical impediment of what I'm putting forward, which is that I think we should strive to be more introspective, and that ultimately at the end of the day, identity is an illusion. However, ultimately at the end of the day, we have serious problems that are, you know, in the real world, and demographics matter, and we have to talk honestly about these things. But I just think it's interesting to get into notions about identity, because it kind of goes all over the place and people ask all kinds of questions, because there is a kind of quality about that conversation that appears contradictory. But I don't think that it is. I think that one can be introspective and can have these experiences of selflessness while still acknowledging that there's a world out there that exists and that we have to act on.
Yeah, and operate within. I mean, this is the big thing with the big cliche about drug users and hippies and all that, is right, that ultimately they can't actually function in the real world until they either stop taking those drugs or learn to control them, because the drugs themselves are a disruptive influence.
Mm. Yeah. Are you anti-drug?
Not completely. I'm skeptical about drugs. I took them in my early 20s, and I can't say that they helped me. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they contributed to my mental illness throughout the rest of my 20s. I don't know for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me either way. Mm. I mean, I do know what you're talking about, because there is that nothingness, the emptiness, when everything is dissolved and, you know, oh, I'm free now and I'm just seeing things as they really are. I know, I went through it. But ultimately, it didn't... And, you know, I'd love to live up to Terence McKenna's expectations and say it did me good and it enlightened me. But I don't think it did. And I feel like I almost feel like I failed an exam. Like I did the drugs and yet it didn't have the effect that everyone talks about. So I don't know whether everyone else is lying or whether I just fucked up. You know, I had three bad trips. And
you really kept going after two. Damn.
Yeah, I had the first two back to, like, consecutively, and then I had a few good, and then I had the third one, and it was just horrendous. but you know, after that, my sort of enjoyment of the whole thing was very much sullied, and each time we took the drugs, I was then on edge about how it was going to turn. I just didn't really enjoy it. And also, I think that they wear off, frankly, after you've done them for a few months, or I don't know how long it was, 6 months or something. It's just not as fun anymore. And then again, you've got to think, well, if you're doing it for fun, then is this selfless?
Mm. I personally think that people should be free to use whatever drugs they want.
Well, I don't know about that. You see, this is one of those issues where I think if the authorities just sort of stood back and let it quietly happen, then it would probably be okay, because only the people who, if it was banned in public, but people could, you know, you wouldn't arrest someone for having a marijuana plant, then that would be the level of authoritarianism there that I would think appropriate. But if you had people selling LSD on the street, like a shop front that said, get your LSD here, I think that would be...
Yeah, you know, there would have to be certain protocols. Like, I believe they're doing it right now in Portugal. You can kind of just do whatever you want. And I think crime has gone down. Don't quote me on that, because I think I read another statistic that said it was actually...
The Portugal thing is really bloody. It's difficult. But I just want to address something. Somebody said, I don't drink, like me, I, millennial, was don't drink because I'm epileptic, but I take LSD. I have never taken LSD because it's a synthetic, and I heard too many horror stories about it, so I've never taken that. Mm-hmm. The drugs that I took were mushrooms, primarily.
Nice, yeah.
Yes, shrooms. And... what else? Salvia, although it didn't have any effect. I think it might have been fake.
Really?
Or was it peyote? I think, yes, peyote had no effect at all. I think that was fake. Salvia was just very boring. And then the main one that had the most powerful effect was, Hawaiian baby wood rose seeds, Argyria nervosa. And that was just astonishing. Oh, my God. It lasted 24 hours. It was like
it was a hallucinogen.
Yeah. After mushrooms got banned in Britain, people started selling legal equivalents, and I don't know how these things were legal, because it was more powerful than mushrooms. Basically, it was like a mushroom trip, but instead of lasting about 4 hours, it lasted 24 hours.
Whoa.
So, and that was something else. But I mean, honestly, it's funny. I just for various reasons, it felt like something that I grew out of it. I just wasn't interested anymore. I think from the age of, I think the last time I would have been about 22, 23. And let me think about this. 24. But beyond that, it just was like, nah, this isn't helping.
Yeah. You know,
this isn't helping me get my life under control. And yeah.
I hear that from people. It's either one of the two. I personally went down the rabbit hole pretty deep and got seriously addicted to a lot of drugs. But I know that for a 24-hour trip will probably get anybody to chill out for a little bit.
I can't remember. It's a long time ago. It's like 2005, so I can't remember how it all. If that was the last time, maybe we. It's difficult. I can't recall now. But anyway, that was the most extreme. Well, that was the most. That was the longest psych by far experience that I had. Most of them, the vast majority of them, it was mushrooms from Hawaii, Colombia, and Mexico. I remember the Hawaiian ones were very powerful. So that was that. But I don't want to go too much on this because it's not the. I mean, I think a lot of people won't be interested in hearing about the psychedelic stuff. And honestly, I don't know that much about it. You know, like I did it for like a 6 month or maybe at the outside 12 month period in my early 20s, and that was really it. So the question of identity then, it ultimately, I mean, it is, I understand what you're saying about it being an illusion, but I think that is sort of indulgent because ultimately you still have that response. I mean, imagine if you said to your parents, well, I know that you identify with me and you raised me and all that, but it's all an illusion, really.
Mm. Well, right. You actually could get to a point where you would say that. I mean, because there are ways of achieving those kinds of states of mind. I'm not saying that people could, but I'm saying that people should. I think that we ought to not be confined by, you know, external factors. This isn't to say that all of a sudden we don't love our families, but it's to say that those kinds of attachments aren't on our conscious experience. We still love our family, but what we see every conscious being the same way we would see our family. So there's no difference between others. So everything you see in your conscious experience, you have boundless love for. And plenty of people have attained these kinds of states through meditation. And you can look at somebody who's at the store with the same kind of love that you would, you know, your mom or your dad. This doesn't mean that you'll, yeah.
Wouldn't your mom or your dad be offended by that?
They probably would, but I mean, that's their own, because would you say that offense, I think you and I might disagree on this, but offense is something that is taken. And so if the mom and dad were like, what the fuck, dude, you care about this guy the same way us, we're your mom and dad. You know what I mean? Well, that's on them to grapple with in their own conscious experience. That's why I personally, or actually, I think
I tend to think that when people say offense is something that's taken, people who say that are playing games, because you are doing something to prompt the other person to take offense. It's ultimately an effect of your own behavior, and thus possibly, whether consciously or not, an intention of your behavior to offend that other person. I'm not saying every time, but there is always that possibility that basically you're fucking around.
Mm. Well, I mean, we disagree. I think that, for instance, it's the contextual framework our minds put around whatever it is that we're, quote, offended by. So you could put someone in a room and sit them down on a chair and then give them a phone, and they're flipping through YouTube videos, and they get offended 20 times. Well, no one's actually there to offend them. They might feel justified because they saw something on CNN that disturbed them. But at the end of the day, they're actually wrestling with sensations and emotions and concepts in their own minds. And once they grapple with that, once they disidentify with that kind of phenomenon, they're able to say, oh, it is me that's actually getting offended. You know, it's not the phone, that's a pixel.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying that people are completely, that they have no say in this matter. Obviously, you can choose to control your instinctual reaction to something.
Mm. Right. I think you're claiming more that, but there's even though we have ownership over it, we can still be affected by someone doing something completely outrageous, and we would be right to be affected by that. Would that be your claim?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah. We would disagree there, but I totally understand why you would think that.
Okay. Some people have asked in the chat that there was a, oh yes. Do you think that these transformations of consciousness are possible for every person in the world?
Yeah, now this puts us right back into the intelligence question. I've thought about this a lot. I don't know if, and I don't know the answer. I can't find any studies linking like intelligence to being able to meditate properly or having achieved different states of consciousness. I do know, however, that the Asian community has been the most prominent within Buddhism, and they're all smart and they're all having these experiences. So even if I'm talking about
So that's
identity,
something. Is that something to do with Asian identity, perhaps?
well, I would say Asian biology, but there's a difference there. I would say that it certainly puts us back in the framework of looking at intelligence, because if different groups aren't able to attain the conscious states because they're not intelligent enough, then that puts you right back in the demographic framework all over again.
But even that would seem to imply that identity is hardwired.
I mean, some sense of being is certainly hardwired, but there's no sense of like okay, so there's this person, and then they give them a name, and then they say he's got to do A, B, and C. They give him this education. They tell him this is how the world works. They give him a science book. They give him a history book. And then all of a sudden, he's mired all of these notions into who he actually is. Well, that's not true. That name was given to you, that these books were given
Yeah,
to you.
I remember Terence McKenna saying something similar, like when a child sees a fluttering bird for the first time, it is just a pure experience. It's beautiful and innocent and all that. But then an adult points to it and says bird, and then the child can never enjoy it in the same way again.
Right. I believe Birdman is another really beautiful film that had a scene with a flower where, was his name Michael Keaton? Is that his name? Or am I wrong about that?
Yes, yes,
Okay, yeah,
yes.
Michael Keaton was like, you don't see this fucking flower. He was talking to a critic, and he was just going off on this chick about how she doesn't actually see the world how it is. She only sees her own contextual framework. She brings her own emotions into whatever film she reviews. And I think that has really, it's a really good allegory for how
Yeah,
life is.
it's somebody being inflexible. They can't step outside their prejudices and biases and just enjoy something for what it is, or rather to just be more open-minded towards it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is annoying. I mean, it's clearly it is a mental block. But to go to the other extreme, obviously experience and culture and education and parenting does that these things do shape a person's identity. But what I would say is, what is the alternative to that? Because it seems like you're saying that the best person or the ideal person is somebody who is not tainted with these artificial or avoidable influences.
I would say
Is
the
that true?
best. I would say the best person is someone who knows they are being tainted by external influences, and the solution or the kind of society that I would talk about. I know a lot of us are idealistic, and we talk about ethno states and stuff like that. So, if I could put this forward, I would prefer to live in a society that's more founded upon introspection, where it becomes a part of the nation's, I guess we could say, identity. It becomes a part of, because again, I'm not tossing out the utility of people coming together on the basis of values, and we can call that identity. And I think that part of that identity should be introspection. It should be like brushing our teeth. You know, like we should, it should become facts. Like we should just know that the self isn't, or at least that the self isn't what we think it is. It's this tricky, transitory thing. Like I assume that you were not as invested in being white 20 or so years ago. It's probably changed, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm invested in being white as such. It's not something that I congratulate myself for each day. I'm more concerned with the people, the group of human beings who are called white.
Right, but that's still part of the identity. So that part of the identity has probably gotten more pronounced and stronger The reason why I'm asking is because if that's true, that grants that identity is also transitory. It shifts around all the time. And we think of ourselves as being the same person we were just yesterday. But we know that we're constantly changing, and that almost moment to moment, if you really, really pay attention to your experience, you realize that there's this thinker that just won't shut the fuck up, that just has ideas about everything. But that actually you can distance yourself from that part of your conscious experience and just see it for what it is. And you notice this transitory nature of identity. It's this motherfucker that keeps changing all the time and getting more pronounced because of this reason, or saying, "Ooh, I like this. I'm going to start doing this. This will be part of my identity now." Or, "Oh, now I have this reputation." And you know what, dude? It gives people meaning. It gives people purpose. It's like, "Oh, well, this is me. This is what I do. I have a lot invested in this." And I think that a lot of alt writers are going into the alt right because it provides them with meaning, and that's totally fine. I'm not downplaying it, but
yeah, I was going to ask, what's wrong with meaning and purpose?
Nothing at all. But I think that we have to ask ourselves: Are we going into these kinds of ideas as the only avenue of finding meaning? And if your answer is yes, then I would say that political activism is useful. But I think that there are better ways of finding meaning in our lives. Way better ways, spiritual ways.
Right. Are they down to the individual, or even, is it the other extreme, sort of beyond all human groups?
Right. Yeah, it would be like, it's like an individual, but it's, but I don't like the word individual because people are so triggered by it. They're like, "Oh, individualism, you're just..." No, it's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that, dude, you're an individual. I'm an individual. Can we not at least say that? And once you start to examine your own conscious state as an individual vessel for consciousness, things can get very interesting. And you'll realize that you're not as confined into these groups, I'm not as confined into these groups as I think I am. That doesn't mean that I toss out the utility of it entirely, though. And say, "Okay, fuck it, I'm no longer this thing because it's actually an illusion." I think that we can begin to utilize identity once we know it for what it is, which is this tricky little bastard that changes all the time and that can guide us in ways that are harmful if we're not careful and aware of it.
Would it be fair to say that you see the ultimate truth as being a communion between an individual and the universe? And that intermediary points between those two things, human groups, are a sort of distraction that are, ridden with delusions.
Yes, Woz, I would. That you summed up my general, my feels there. You got my feels.
Oh, I'm not trying to degrade it in any way.
No, that was brilliant. I'm saying you just nailed it. Yeah, I think that's awesome. That's my general, I'm always trying to come up with more universal principles, which is why the alt-right, I get it. I know why white identity is on the rise. It's so fucking obvious. We know why. It's mere reactions. And you, when you see one side of the political arena behaving the way they are, the left generally, we know why this is happening. And I think that I'm saying none of that's good. This is not good. These people on the left that keep talking about their racial identity, that's not good, because look what you're doing to these people on the right. You're fucking freaking them out. You know what I mean? And bringing in all these people who are making more babies of different races, you can't do that either, dude. That's fucking going to freak them out. You're going to make them think they're losing their race and shit. So it's totally justified. But I just don't like any of it. I think that it's I don't think it's right. I just don't think it's...
Here's a question from the chat. Can you meditate away being a white male? And what would the consequences be of that?
Is he defining white male as just being biologically white?
Yes.
No, you cannot meditate away your biology.
So the biological part of your identity is hardwired.
Well, I mean, that we'll see. That depends what you're saying there, because it's like the biological part of your identity is just consciousness. I mean, I don't know. It would have to be, because there's a relationship between consciousness and, you know, the brain, which is a piece of biology. And you certainly cannot meditate away your brain. I think what they're getting at is they're trying to hold on to some semblance of and again, I'm not saying that, I'm not spitting in the face of identity. I understand it, but it's just like you said before, when you paraphrased it, the way that I view reality, there's no way that I would ever be able to be an identitarian, because I would just constantly be like, this is ridiculous. Like, I just wouldn't be able to do it.
You think that a sort of a group identity is an imperfect lens through which to view reality?
Yes. However, I understand the utility of it in certain respects. Like, and I'm also willing to engage in group identity all the time. I mean, I'm in AA, so, you know, we gather around and talk about stuff under a common identity of helping others. And there are, you know, certain criteria to the identity that binds us. But I'm under no illusions that it's like this real thing. But it still has use. It still has utility. And I'm grateful for it. But at the end of the day, I think that our path through conscious experience is very much a personal one. And navigating this conscious space is something that I do not want to take for granted, and I want to do it right. And I want to make sure that I just want to make sure I get everything right, because I don't have another chance to do it. Or at least that's what I believe.
I think you're putting too much pressure on yourself.
Well, if there was a self to put pressure on.
There is, because who the fuck else am I talking to?
I know. I was playing.
All but, right, being facetious, all right.
Right.
But just for the sake of it, because I want to sort of bring this back. In that town, 2,000 people, 1,000 of them are black, and 1,000 of them are white. Which of those groups do you think would give you safety?
The white people.
And would you give them safety?
Both. Absolutely.
All right.
Well, hold on though. Before you, hold on. Really quick. I would say that I am by no means denying that different groups exist and that they are like kind of like families. And that me feeling safe in either one of those groups is still ultimately a fault on my own conscious experience. But at the end of the day, there's a practical impediment, and it you know, different groups exists. And so I understand why you asked that question. And it's a very practical question. And
well, ultimately, everything has to come back to what you are as an animal. I mean, you have to test this philosophical concept against the reality of things and your limited abilities as a being in that reality, you know. And this is why I asked it. Ultimately, yes, you can say what you like about identity, but in the real world, you are a white male.
Right, but just don't, I totally understand what you're saying, but just don't let that negate the truth that identity is ultimately illusory. And if we find ourselves in a safe enough environment, then we can start to really, you know, practice these experiences. So I totally get what you're saying. I think that the solution would be to cultivate the kinds of environments we would need so that we could be leisure enough to actually facilitate these kinds of conscious shifts I'm talking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I do understand. I wonder what the point would be of doing that. You see, this is why I say I think you're putting too much pressure on yourself. You seem to want to demand of yourself that you be essentially a calculator instead of a being, you know, with an identity. because you're worried that that identity would sully your perceptions of things.
Well, but I mean,
is it a crime? You know, is that a crime to be something with its with biases and prejudices and a perspective on the world? It's not.
Right.
And obviously it's better if you can transcend that occasionally, but as a general mode of being, it is not a bad thing.
Right. And don't get me wrong, I think that there's a relationship between the two, and that there is this kind of being within me, within all of us, that is pristine. And that just because, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, dude, most of the time, I would say, not most of the time, but like the, like 85% of the time, I am neurotic, just like everyone else, and just a mess, and I'm not meditating, and I'm, you know, thinking about all kinds of stuff. I'm just mired in my identity. But I really value those times when I'm able to drop out and kind of see it for what it is and get that hit of reality. So yeah, it's a very difficult thing to explain, because, but yeah, I am hard on myself, but there is a space of consciousness which, you know, doesn't.
You definitely are hard on yourself. I think you should just allow yourself to, you know, be a half Scottish, half Spanish white male. I mean, it's not a crime. It doesn't mean you can't understand other people's perspectives or that you're closed off from them. It's fine.
There's just so many other things besides that I would go to first, like besides just identifying as my race. I feel like there's so many other factors.
Yeah, but presumably they're also illusory parts of your identity, so you'd dismiss them as well if you could. I mean, it seems to be a sort of dismantlement that you're engaging in, or trying to, or aspiring to.
No, it's not. It's as simple as this. It's as simple as once a person has an experience where they are able to be so present that it is that your whole body is vibrating. It's a very sensational experience. And all it is it's awareness getting bigger. So you can be aware of your hands. You can be aware of your feet. You can be aware of your knee. And then you can be aware of your feet, your hand, and your knee at the same time. And then you can start hearing things. You can start building up this awareness to where it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until that which you are gets encompassed within awareness as well. And there is just empty space. And so that's what I love. And maybe I'm chasing it like a fucking drug, because I am a drug addict. And that's like the number one thing you're not supposed to do in Buddhist thought, is to chase it. But I probably am. But anyways.
I think that you should go easy on yourself, Mithy. Forgive yourself. Honestly. I mean, it sounds like you're torturing yourself.
No.
And I'm not saying that to ruin anything. It just sounds like you really go hard on yourself.
Oh, I do. Dude, I mean, hear me. Like, I have been, since I was 15, I said it before, dude, I've been an addict for, now I'm 28. I've been sober about a year, maybe a year and a half, in and out of treatment centers, all kinds of crazy shit, you know, stealing from people, because the thing that I took was Xanax, which just completely annihilates the thinking patterns. It cuts away at the frontal lobe of the brain, and it just balls to the wall. So if there's any part of me that's grateful for my own neuroticism, it's that it spins me into these creative, obsessive moments. I don't know how, but I landed in a mind that is actually kind of creative, and I'm definitely grateful for that. But yeah, dude, I've always been my own worst enemy, and that's why I get so much relief when I'm free from it for a little bit.
I think I understand. Well, thank you for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, I did want to get onto another topic with you, but I think it wouldn't be fitting for this conversation. So let's leave it for another time. But okay, so that was Mouthy Buddha, and I really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you for it. All right, so that's it for tonight. I think tomorrow night, it's another four people starting. James also, Black Pigeon Speaks, Eric the Heathen, and Lovely Porridge. So there we are. I'll see you all then. In the meantime, thank you, Mouthy Buddha.
Thank you.